perfectly taking me on to my next guest, the topic, are leaders born or made? So I'd like to say hi to Ivy Business School Prof Gerard Seitz, who's in town to do all sorts of things. Good morning.
Good morning, Phil. How are you today?
Great. This is something that fascinates me. There seems to be a notion that you either are a great leader or you're an also-ran who's better off peeling the potatoes or whatever. But I wonder what, very basically speaking, your mantra about this would be.
Sure. Well, I think this is, of course, a question that people ask themselves all the time, whether leaders are born or made. I think that's an utterly false dichotomy.
Yeah.
Clearly, the answer is both, right? I think talent or leadership aptitude is a necessary but certainly not sufficient condition, and there is literally many ways in which we can learn to improve our leadership in business, in government, in sports, and the like. So the answer really is both. The question, of course, is, are people truly interested in learning to become a better leader? Are they willing to put in the time, the effort that it takes?
Well, I mean, in your day-to-day life, Ivy Business School, it's one of the top business schools in the world. But if you don't mind today, I'd like to take it a little out of the corporate world and just talk in general about characters. Now, if we open our history books, very often the people who are considered to have been great leaders or just leaders, they seem to be ruthless and they often seem to have a very frail temperament.
Right. And so, you know, take a guy like Churchill, right?
Yeah.
People very much admired the man because of his leadership during a wartime. Very strong. What oftentimes people forget is soon after the war, he was defeated, right?
Yeah.
He ceased to be an effective leader in the eyes of individuals. You know, Phil, one of the things that we do some research on in the Ivy School is the role of leadership character,
okay,
right? That really speaks to the fact who leaders are, in addition to what it is that they do. And, for example, during the financial crisis, we talked a lot about, you know, what happened, how leaders contributed. We talked a lot about leadership and courage, leadership and risk-taking, confidence. Of course, we all want leaders to be confident, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a virtue can easily turn into a vice when we have too much of it, right? So confidence can easily turn into reckless behavior that makes a great leader, a good leader, who took too much risk, who became too confident, who stopped learning to lead, that becomes a liability.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I said of a frail temperament as well, very often, I mean, the obvious one that springs to Adolf Hitler, ruthless and frail temperament, because look how he ended up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you're talking about Churchill as well. There's always a price to pay, Gerard, because by all accounts, Churchill was a very ungainly man, or personally speaking, very not a confident man personally because of his appearance. He abused his body with smokes and alcohol.
Yeah. So I'm not sure exactly what the question is, Phil, here, but clearly I've seen many leaders who people might see as very frail and perhaps lacking in confidence. But you know, they still bring great things to the leadership role. Many people that they interviewed for the book, for example, were not exactly the leaders you thought they would be.
Okay.
In the sense that they were quiet people, they were calm people. They were underestimated as leaders, right? And that's a bad thing to do. One of the people that came to mind is a guy by the name of Mike Harris. He's the former premier of Ontario. He was a golf guy, liked to play golf, was a golf instructor, former teacher. People underestimated him. And then, of course, as a premier, he became lethal in terms of effectiveness. So this whole thing about being frail, be careful what you wish for, because we underestimate, I think, leaders too often.
Yeah, let me be a tiny bit clearer. Sorry about that. What I meant was they pay a price in their personal lives often. Yes, it's a generalization, but the public persona, the great leadership skills, and then behind closed doors, these can be very weak individuals.
Absolutely, I agree.
Yeah. Let's look at in our lifetime here. I mean, one of the great guys who stands up as everybody looks up to this fellow as a great leader was, of course, Bill Clinton. And often people can't explain why.
Yeah. Well, I think many people, at least in the U.S., like Bill Clinton because he was a phenomenal communicator. He was able to relate to individuals. Many people would say he had great emotional intelligence. He was a very, very likable guy.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, we also had his weaknesses, as both you and I know, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But it did seem to impinge on his career that much.
Absolutely. And I think, well, a couple of things. It did when he was the president, right?
Yeah.
I mean, public opinion, took a turn real quick. But I think people are forgiving. Time heals wounds. And he's now seen as an icon, and I think many people would like, quite frankly, to go back of the time of Bill Clinton when there was prosperity in the United States and so forth. Here's the thing that I've learned through that research, right? And people always bring up the name of Bill Clinton. One of the things I picked up through the research is a fantastic quote. It was given to me by Arkady Kuhlman. He is the former director, president, and CEO of ING Direct USA. And he said that life is a blackboard that you cannot erase. Everything counts. There's no such a thing as a timeout for a leader, right? And so this really speaks to the issue that as leaders, we better be very aware of what we do, what we don't do. As leaders, we are on 24/7. And I think to some extent, Bill Clinton might have forgotten that. He forgot that, you know, your personal and your public life, there are many times, oftentimes, you cannot separate them. People, of course, his public opinion turned against him, but, you know, 10 years later, he's an icon, and people love him, right?
A lot of times, when it comes to politics, people will say, I trust this guy, I believe this guy, and you said the word charisma just now. Bizarrely enough, somebody who springs to mind for me was somebody who unfortunately isn't with us anymore, and that was Jack Layton.
Yes.
I mean, he had something. Obviously, you know, he didn't survive. But tell us a bit about this guy.
It is remarkable. I would say what he had was he was able to take things at a very personal level.
Yeah.
He had incredible likability. People didn't always like his policies. But you know what? If you were to ask the Canadian public about the three Canadian leaders, right? So the Liberal leader, you have a Conservative leader, and of course the NDP, Jack Layton. Who do you want to drink, have a beer with?
That's it, isn't it?
People, who want to play guitar with? People always said Jack Layton. He was a jovial guy, a very likable guy, easy to relate to. And I think that's part of leadership as well, right?
Yeah.
To really listen to people, have conversations with them. Yeah, Jack Layton, he left us too soon.
A big hole there, yeah. I mean, other people that will stand up and essentially take a metaphorical bullet for the people who support him.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think that a person that comes to mind actually is the former Canadian Prime Minister, Paul Martin, right?
Okay.
Who really stood up, almost took a bullet for the gay marriage, right? Even people in his own political party weren't quite sure where he was going, but he had a certain set of principles, right, that were so important to him. And, you know, and I think that's leadership as well. It's not a popularity contest. Oftentimes in politics it is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think good leadership, if not great leadership, is that you clearly put your beliefs, your values on the table. This is who I am. And then, of course, it is your role as a leader, right, to create buy-in, commitment, have people understand. Because another lesson that I learned is that, you know, as a leader, you know, if you're trying to lead and nobody's following you, you're just taking a walk, right?
Yeah.
And you don't want to be in a position like that. So, you know, people like Paul Martin, Jack Layton, relate to the people, they create buy-in, they're excellent communicators, and for that reason, I think they're very effective.
All right, well, the past couple of characters we've mentioned are fellas who've been elected. Let's take it back into the corporate situation here. Is one of the problems that people who get promoted into terrifically high-powered jobs are not, by nature, leaders, that they get there through what's called dead men's shoes?
Yes. I think in many ways, perhaps we have failed in organizations to really prepare people for the hard and difficult role of leadership. You know, it's very challenging at times. You know, take a guy like Steve Jobs, right? I know that maybe 50%, if I were to do a poll, they would absolutely love Steve Jobs, what he stood for, a great visionary, brought us many, many great inventions, but I think as a human being, many people would argue he failed us miserably. He was mean-spirited, he was very political, very, very impatient, hard to deal with. As you know, this is public knowledge, he had a daughter for years, did not want to have anything to do with her. People had raised serious concerns about Steve Jobs as a human being, as a person, but as a visionary, there's perhaps, you know, no better example than Steve Jobs.
It sort of takes me a little bit back to my thing about the personal cost. But a lot of times you see that these guys are absolute warriors, and they're functioning on a very personal level. I'm sure Steve Jobs wasn't thinking, do they like me? He's just thinking, hey, I've got this gadget.
Absolutely. And, you know, he wasn't worrying at all because he was trying to create value for people. And he's legendary for doing those things. That's, listen, I don't care what you think or what people are thinking. I'm going to create something. And the people will like it. The people will come, right? And so I think that was part of his charm, so to speak.
Do you turn on the news when you're in, I don't know, CBC or whatever, and you find all the world tearing its heart, you look at leaders, and do you ever find yourself sort of saying, this guy's got it, this guy hasn't?
Yes. You know, routinely, we you know, at the Ivy Business School, we try to bring live cases into the class. We might first start off the first 5 minutes talking about just what happened in the news, what didn't happen, and so forth. So, you know, we better be relevant, up to date, absolutely.
Do you get stuck into the ways of certain parts of the world? For instance, I mean, I've known people write books on doing business in China, you know, an Asian way or a Middle Eastern way. They're all rather different.
Yes, well, actually, so here's what I did for the book, Phil. This was quite interesting, and again, arguably my sample size is very small. But I traveled to India, and I met with three leaders. And, of course, I did my homework. They were very high-profile people, rose to the ranks. Top, you know, they're really the CEOs and the chairman. I didn't really know them. It was an eye-opener for me, because what I found is at least those three people that I spoke to were very grounded individuals, very humble, which was interesting because they are, you know, very well-to-do. I also spoke to a leader in Canada, it's a female, Jody Wilson-Raybould. Jody is the regional chief of the British Columbia Assembly of First Nations. The First Nations have a very interesting approach to leadership. It is very communal. Community is incredibly important, right? It's about consensus, and we take the time to make decisions. I gave a presentation this morning to the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, and they talked about kind of the leadership in Asia, which I don't think is all that different, right? Community, very, very important, very much around the we. And I think sometimes in North America, it's all about the I, my company, I have done, and so forth. Very different at times.
That's so interesting. Does community hint at trust being very important?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that goes back to kind of the followership, right? I think at times people tend to forget that leadership in many ways is relational, right? There is no leadership without followers. So especially people that are very kind of egocentric, focus on the I and my achievements, at times maybe they might have difficulties creating that followership, might be a bit easier in Asian cultures and so forth.
So would you be able to put, let's assume we're talking about good or great leaders here, would you put them in different categories? Would you put the warriors? Would you put the empathists? Would you put them in different boxes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things, Phil, that we discuss a lot is about leadership and leadership styles. You know, even if I'm in Canada, even within one particular organization, you have different styles of leadership, dominant approaches. And one of the exercises that we use, and see if I recall my facts correctly, is kind of a test, an instrument, a diagnostic, a conversation piece, where through a series of questions, we put people in different categories. So one category would be the North. We call them the North. These guys are the warriors. They want to take things on. They are the drivers. They want to be in charge. They want to lead things, right? That's their dominant approach. We contrast that with the South. The South are really people that are high in nurturing. They care about kind of due process, fairness, that if I work in a team setting, everybody needs to have kind of an opportunity to voice his or her opinion. I have the Wests, right? The West are the kind of the critical thinkers. They look at numbers. They look at data. Oftentimes, it's analysis paralysis because they want to do more analysis, right? And then we have the East. The East are the visionaries. Those are kind of the Steve Jobs, the people that always think about the big, the bold ideas. You know, it's about the flavor of the month. And I think, of course, what's sometimes challenging is for people to navigate through those different styles, right? Or certainly if you are a team leader, to have these different people work with one another.
Do you know what? I'm thinking right now that I wouldn't be having a completely different conversation if I were chatting now with an expert on parenting.
Well, you know, people brought it up all the time, and to be honest, you know, if I look at the research questions becoming a better leader, right, many of those principles applies to parents as well, kind of self-reflection, right? Learning. At times, it's, as a parent, we have to stretch ourselves, right? And pay, perhaps take a little bit of risk, which is the case with leaders as well.
Yeah.
Observing. I think our kids are always, they're always looking at us. In many ways, we are a role model. Leaders, just by virtue of their position in the organization, right, what they say, what they do, what they sanction, they serve as a role model 24/7, right? And I think sometimes leaders forget that. Parents forget that too.
I'm talking to Professor Gerard Seitz from the Ivy Business School. You mentioned the book. Tell us about the book.
The book is Good Leaders Learn, Lessons from Lifetimes of Leadership. It's based on 30-plus interviews with, I would say, fairly high-profile leaders from all segments of society, business leaders, leaders in government, sports, the arts and sciences, education, and so forth. And the fundamental question I wanted to pursue was, how do leaders learn to lead? It's a journey. So what are some of those critical moments, right? How does a leader or a person with leadership ambition learn to become a leader, and how does a leader learn to become an even better leader? And I think this is a critical question because, Phil, you know, you talked earlier about kind of the newspapers, the headlines. It's no surprise that I think the world craves for better leadership, right? And so we have work to do, certainly at the Ivy School of Business. You know, we care deeply about leadership. We ask several questions, important questions: what good leaders do, who good leaders are, but most fundamentally, and certainly the topic of this book, how good leaders are being developed. And that's what kept me busy for the past 18 months.
Just before we finish, not everybody is one of these. Now, you have some very talented students, I'm sure, but have you ever had to say to one of them, you're talented, but you're not a leader, so let's find out what you can do?
Absolutely. This is part of our role as executives, and, quite frankly, educators, to sit people down and help people learn. Because, as I said earlier, Phil, people might be born, they might have all kinds of predispositions that set them up for a good leadership career. But every leader might have one or more fatal flaws, right? And so if we observe things that are getting in a person's way, we owe it to the person to have a conversation. We owe it as educators in universities to say, not so fast, here's what I've observed. And quite frankly, I've seen in too many organizations, right, where people do not have the confidence or the willingness to engage in candid conversations, right, developmental
yes.
conversations,
yeah.
and say, this is not going to work if you go from one level to a more senior level.
Gerard,
Gerard,
I'm afraid we're out of time, but this fascinating stuff, Good Leaders Learn. It'll all be revealed there. I hope you have a fantastic time in Hong Kong, and thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Phil. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. Take care. Professor Gerard Seitz there from the Ivy Business School. Let's get to the news.